Oh yeah. All right. 3, 4.
From JulianaHatfield.com. Universal Heartbeat. What a trip, I'm better for it. That will be me when I get through this thing I'm going through. This song is all about depression. When we make it to the other side, we can feel triumphant, landing on a crowded shore, high-fiving, and so grateful for having survived. Also, we can't help but develop an empathy for the suffering of others after going through something so painful. Maybe those of us who feel and think deeply, who suffer a lot inside, who are kind of mental, are not to be pitied for our frequent aches, but should be patted on the back for sticking it out when it hurts so much. We who don't ever give up and who continue to believe that things can, that we can be better. We are alive, we are not numb. We fight on and on and on. We fight our self-destructive urges. We refuse to close up our hearts and become bitter and dead inside in order not to experience the frequent hurts of an ultra-sensitive soul, mind, heart. Sometimes I feel like a human pincushion. Every painful emotion hits me with ridiculously exaggerated force, and the anxiety feels like hands inside of me, squeezing my guts really hard. For the most part, I have not ever been inclined to escape with drugs and alcohol. In the drugs and alcohol sense, I am and have always been very straight. My coping mechanism, or one of them, the one that kicked into high gear again most recently, has been restricting food. We swim through the deep, dark oceans to reach the crowded shore. Lots of people have made it through the same sort of experiences. We are not alone. It just feels like we are when we're in the thick of it. And after one of us endures one of these things, she may be transformed into a more humble and compassionate person, high-fiving all the other freaks and mental defectives and addicts who have continued to survive and to try. I am having to come to terms with the fact that at age 41, I found myself unraveling. Or rather, I unraveled. I wasn't fully conscious of it. Others around me noticed it before I did. A good friend forced me to confront the fact that I was in serious trouble. "You need to get well," were his words. He was there when I woke up in the middle of the night, drenched in sweat, pajamas soaked, hair wet, sheets wet, even the pillow with a head-sized wet spot on it, where my head was. He witnessed my fatigue, my falling asleep every time he put on a movie for us at night. I tried so hard to stay awake with him to watch Sunshine and Network for about the fifth time. And The Stranger and the DVD with Robert Thurman talking with the Dalai Lama, but they're all just blurry in my mind. I was dehydrated and anemic, anemia caused by malnutrition, and I didn't even know it. I didn't realize the seriousness of my problem until I had already entered dangerous territory. My anxiety was so great and all-consuming, funny choice of words considering I was consuming so little, that at some point I lost my appetite completely, and it was no more about restricting food but became an almost inability to eat. My weight went as low as it had ever been in my adult lifetime. They tell me here at the ED treatment center that people have been hospitalized for being as low at my height as I was when I came here. I found that kind of alarmist and hard to believe. I was still skeptical and in a little bit of denial, like everyone is when they first come in for treatment for anything anywhere. But it scared me anyway. In this environment, they shorten eating disorders, the name of our problem, to ED, and say it like a man's name, Ed. Like he's a bad man. An evil man whom we need to cast out of our lives and our psyches. Before computers, you would never have found me blabbing so openly like this about this. This is me being modern. Damn these computers and this interweb and the pressure on us musicians to update constantly and to communicate. It encourages, inspires oversharing. It's so easy to say too much and to feel safe giving away one's private secrets. But screw it, I have nothing to hide. I've been embarrassing myself publicly for over 20 years. Why should I stop now? A heart that hurts is a heart that works. I will shout out from the rooftop as I contemplate jumping, but then ultimately don't jump, that is, and walk back indoors. I am not dead inside. I still care about right and wrong. I refuse to succumb, to accept that I can't fix this. I want desperately to be a better, happier, healthier, saner person and companion. My will to endure is, so far, unkillable. They make us eat 6 times a day. 3 meals and 3 snacks. We all sit in the kitchen together, and there's a monitor at the head of the table making sure we eat everything on our plates and drink everything in our cups. This is called the refeeding process. It must be done slowly and steadily, with more food added on as time progresses so we don't shock our systems. So we're not in danger of ending up like Karen Carpenter. She gained too much weight too fast after starving for a long time, and her heart couldn't take it. The bathroom doors are locked, so the bulimics can't go in and puke. I myself have never been a purger. When you need to go, you must ask a monitor to unlock the door for you, and after she lets you in, she stands just outside the door, and then you must either count while you're on the toilet, loud enough so that she can hear you, right up until the moment you exit, or you must let her flush for you after you are done, so that there is proof that you didn't vomit your food into the toilet. Every morning they wake us up at 7, and we all put on hospital johnnies, first thing, and go and have our vitals, temperature, blood pressure, checked, and have ourselves weighed. I have gained 5 pounds so far. I'm doing well. I'm a model patient, weight-gaining-wise. My mental emo health is another story, a longer story, a work in progress. All I want is to be well and to have energy to get back on track and to have my quiet little life back. It was a lonely and solitary life, but it was mine, and I was basically healthy-ish. And I was free in a sense. When the damage is done, you're damaged goods. I am damaged goods, truly, but I don't want to complain. I am what I am. Others have it worse than I do. In fact, it could be worse is my motto and my mantra. Cry in the Dark. Paul Westerberg once told me to not put my best songs at the end of the album. Put them up front where people will hear them. But he doesn't take his own advice, answering machine, etc., so why should I? This is another song about being sad and socially retarded, but full of sonic light and effervescence, and some lyrical hopefulness, too. Every day you mime a prayer, though your faith is shaken. Isn't that the definition of hope and faith? Waiting for the peace to come back, believing, even in the darkest darkness, that it will? You only want to be loved sums it up. Isn't that all anyone wants? My dad used to say that I would never understand what it means to be happy unless and until I fell in love. Real love. He died before he got to see me really happy, but I like to think he can observe me now from time to time. Anyway, David Kahn commissioned this recording, plus a few others, so he could gauge my progress as a writer, singer, and potential signee to his record company at the time. I think it was Columbia. He set me up in a studio in a big converted barn in suburban Philadelphia with a drummer-producer named Andy Kravitz. The reverb was in the basement. David gave Andy specific instructions to not let me play guitar. "Don't let her play guitar, I want her to play bass," he said, or words to that effect. He thought I was an interesting bass player, and he'd been disappointed when I gave it up for six string after the Blake Babies split up. I agree that I'm an interesting bass player, but playing the bass gives me a headache. It's kind of like doing math problems for me, and I never liked math. I like the end result of my bass playing, listening back to the finished songs, but the process of getting to the good stuff is tedious and kind of difficult sometimes. My playing on this song is somewhat characteristically spastic. I say somewhat because I held back some, probably because I was in a foreign environment, not a studio or a town I was used to. If you compare this performance to the old Blake Baby stuff, you'll see what I mean. I recorded my vocals in the control room without using headphones, singing along to the musical tracks coming through the room speakers. That was a first for me, and it was freeing. Headphones can be stifling. The sound that comes through them is not real sound. When sound comes through the air, it is real sound, I think. Andy played the omnichord. What a beautiful sound. I need one of those. And the key change at the end. Why does it make me so happy to hear it every time it happens? There isn't enough modulating happening in music these days. I've got to set an example and bring it back. I vow to put a last chorus modulation in the next song I write.
Do you cry in the dark? 'Cause it's easier to be alone than to talk. When the words aren't working and you don't know how to explain these thoughts. Every look and every emotion has a deeper meaning. Everybody hurts nobody. You cry.
This song is kind of all over the place lyrically, kind of stream of consciousness. Overall, though, it seems to be expressing discontent and frustration, but also a sense of utter resignation. I like to liken Made in China to a sonic white flag. I was thinking of an ex-boyfriend who was a really good liar, James in my book, when I wrote, "It's a basic need to lie and be believed." This was his need, not mine, his and so many other people's. Lots of people lie. I want to tell the truth, but telling the truth doesn't always pay off like I, in my innocence, think it will. Telling the truth sometimes gets me nowhere. In fact, it often hurts me. I am forever wounding myself by not holding back the truth. What is wrong with me, I wonder? Why can't I just be like everyone else and learn how to play the games that people play? Why do I have to make everything needlessly difficult and complicated? Why am I always trying to get to the bottom of things when there is no bottom, really? Step out of line and you will have arrived takes a different tack. It's a basic contrarian stance. In this, I am proudly, not regretfully, contrarian. To be unique is to have value. This attitude comes naturally to me. Standing in line, joining, following, conforming never made any sense to me. I always wanted to step out of line, not get in it with all the other sheep. How else to distinguish myself and to feel interesting and creative? I tend to create difficulties for myself. Maybe I do this so I have an excuse when things fall apart, so I can blame myself rather than have to deal with the horror of an unfair world, a world that deals us blows with no rhyme or reason. If I fuck it up myself, at least there is a reason I can point to for it going to hell, to shit, to the dogs. I am forever trying to solve unsolvable problems. I create problems just so I can try to solve them. "I'll Sing to the Clock Because No One Came" was a direct reference to a Some Girls gig in Eugene, Oregon. I told my booking agent to book us in all of the cities I'd never played before. Eugene, Salt Lake City, Las Vegas, Des Moines, and others. Thinking, I've never been, ever, all these years I've been putting out records. They'll be dying to see me. Starved. Boy, was I wrong. Turns out people forget really easily what you may have accomplished in the past, and no one showed up at any of those cities. My strategy failed. There were literally about 5 people in the Eugene audience. I cried before I went on. I couldn't help it. It just happened. The floodgates opened and I couldn't control it. Finally, I dried my eyes and tried to hide the fact that I'd wept like a wuss, and then I went out on stage and focused my performance on the big clock hanging on the wall opposite me across the room, just so I didn't get too sad about the fact that the room was basically empty and start crying again. "Tell me something" is like, come on, show me what you got. Something, anything, excite me. I'm bored, tired, weary, entertain me, and live in this joint. Kickstart my brain, my ho-hum, tedious, predictable existence. But don't say nothing, grammatically incorrect, in the southern vernacular of the ex-boyfriend is saying, just forget it. Shut up. Just don't talk. Don't try to make this any better. There's no point. It's hopeless. Acknowledging the futility of the original entreaty of tell me something. You don't know what it's like to be perfect. I am saying no one is perfect. Not me, not you, not anyone. You think I think I'm perfect? If you only knew how colossally imperfect I think I am. So how can you put me down? It's like beating a dead horse, sort of. Ridiculous. I am saying it's silly to attack me personally simply because you don't like my music or my musical persona. I guess it's okay if it makes you feel better, but you don't need to do it for my benefit or to put me in my place or anything like that, because I already know I am a worm. If you think I'm a super cool badass motherfucking hot mama, you don't know me. You have me all wrong. And so you have no real business judging me, and I can't take your judgment seriously. If your criticism is based on an untruth, I think I'm hot shit, or a misconception, she thinks she's better than me, it's not valid or fair. You can hate my music, okay, that's fair enough, but leave me out of it, please. You know, let he who is without flaws throw the first vicious personal attack on a stranger, or whatever. I am flawed, yes, I readily acknowledge this every chance I get, and you would know this if you were paying attention. And so are you, and so is everyone. Shine a light on a sob story. People love to ogle a tabloid tragedy. Any old sad story. Overdose, disease, divorce, arrest, bankruptcy, alcoholism, sex addiction, adultery, where is she now, failure, aging, beauty, going to seed, plastic surgery, disasters, whatever. This is the age of boredom. People are numb and uninspired and directionless, so they watch TMZ and stuff like that, and look at Star magazine to distract themselves from the undeniable, ever-present fact of their meaningless day-to-day existence. And most of them own guns. Boredom, anhedonia, and deadly weapons. A scary combo. For some, there's nothing to believe. There's such ennui and disillusionment and emptiness and lack of concentration and absence of deep thought and of consciousness and of connections between things. Flip a coin to live or die. That's how random everything is. How little a life means to some people. Such disrespect for the preciousness of being alive in the world. We are all one moment away from the end of the here and now. Can't they see that? Doesn't that mean anything? Doesn't it make everything, every moment, matter more? I cherish this life, this flawed, imperfect, wondrous, mysterious, fascinating, painful, joyous little life, knowing that it is a mote in the eyelash of a blink in the history of the universe. When I complain in my songs, it's only because I want things to be better, and I believe things can and will be better. I wouldn't complain if I thought everything was hopeless. I'm not a nihilist. I have tons of doubt, and I question everything endlessly, but I am a moral person, in that I hate myself when I mess up, and I want and need to always continue to try to do the right thing. But it's not always easy to know what is the right thing. Sorry, bad English.
Thank you.
This lonely love. This lonely love is the love of a song, of somebody else's music. It's love for a voice or for the spirit in the voice. When I listen to certain singers, a certain singer in this case, I feel an intense and painful longing because of the fact that the voice hits me like an arrow in some deep primal elemental part of my being, of my psyche, of all the lives I have lived and don't even remember but can feel when I hear the sound. And sometimes it feels stronger than any connection I've ever had with any actual person that I actually knew. But it is a lonely love, the love of a song or for the god in a singer's voice. It is a lonely love because you can't touch what you love. You never can. You can't even see it. You can't hold it. You can't put its arms around you. I remember once cradling my boombox in my arms and crying and then hugging the boombox close to me and, like, squeezing it with one speaker next to my ear. Something in the singer's voice and melody and words, I guess, touched my heart so hard and moved me, and I just wanted so badly to grab onto it. I saw you in my mind in flashing colors. That's music. It's a song, a voice, a melody that I can't get out of my head. It haunts me and taunts me, and I love it more than anything, and I can never have it. There was a guy. He made music. I was a fan, obviously. Had been for a long time. I was staying in Manhattan, and I went to see him sing, play in some tiny back room of an already tiny bar in Brooklyn, and it was a great show and everything. About 7 people in the audience made it more special, secret, private, mysterious. And then I got a car to take me back to NYC, and then I went home to Boston eventually, and overall I just felt so bereft. I sort of trailed this guy out to the deepest boondocks of Brooklyn, with which I am totally unfamiliar, thinking that maybe it was the guy himself that I felt connected to, even after all this time knowing that it is never the guy. It is always only his music. Always. Only. The guy is never what I want. What I want is in the music, and it is never in the person. I think that it finally sunk in after that night, and then I wrote the song. It was Andy Chase's idea to take the piano and guitar riff from It Should Have Been You and to build a new song around them. I went along with it because I too felt something more could be made out of those two parts, and it was fun, and I don't have to pay myself for the sample. I'm not going to keep it a secret that I sampled myself. In fact, the opposite is true. I wanted to see if people were paying attention. You are. Good. I would have been worried and disappointed if no one had noticed that I'd blatantly ripped off the piano part and the guitar riff from the In Exile Dio song.
Street.
like you and he's got your hands. You're big in small circles, maybe big in friends, but my country just never gave a damn. It should have been you.
Let's blow it all. I imagined a young girl signing a record contract, but with the mind of someone who has been in the business for years. She is a girl who is aware of the whims of the marketplace and who understands the fickle loyalties that waver and in some cases disappear. She knows that they'll forget about her at some point, unless she dies young and pretty, which she has every intention of not doing, in which case she will be remembered forever. And she knows that her worth as cultural currency will inevitably diminish as it does. We're defeated before we start, a friend once said to me, of our generation. I don't know if I agree with him. We just have to try to hold on to something really hard and see if it takes us somewhere good. The girl decides with bitter sweetness to use the money now for splendid things because she knows it's most likely the only money she's ever going to see from the powers that determine the financial fates of sensitive young artists. But she's grateful, so grateful and humble, even while resigned and jaded for ever having been considered for the deal for the position she's in as a signee. It's more than she ever dreamed of. It's almost like she's giving up in a way before she has had the chance to prove anything to anybody. But maybe this is the smartest, correct position to take. Because why should we ever have to prove anything to anybody? Why do we bother competing and performing and such? You learn that the people with the power don't really have real power, they just have money. And that real power is within you. Real power is integrity and faith in oneself. So to throw money away, to blow it all, is in a sense a defensible attitude. Not hoarding money for oneself is a kind of celebration of what really matters. It's celebrating real power. It's laughing in the face of the powered by money. And in this case, it's using the money for good causes. Except for the crashing the car part, that's kind of nihilistic and meaninglessly destructive and unreal. The deliberate crashing of the car was meant to be more of a symbolic idea than a real plan. The money is better spent in productive ways. What is good and true and meaningful and lasting are all of those things, good, true, etc., no matter what. With or without the money, with or without the record deal, with or without the hype, the praise, the accolades, the strong record sales, the TV appearances. Either you're beautiful on the inside, or you're not. Either you believe in yourself and your worth, or you don't, regardless of what the world says or doesn't say. This can't be real. That's exactly how I felt when I held my first record company advance check in my hands. Well, in a sense, I was exactly right. Advance money is an advance against the artist's future earnings. It is basically a loan. In this sense, it isn't real. It's play money, or negative money. It's the illusion of money, but still. How did I get so lucky? I knew I hadn't earned it yet. It was too soon. I didn't deserve it. And I knew others would think the same of me, because if I think something, chances are someone else will think it too, as I am not that radically different from anyone else. My voice, my songs, my personality, my confidence weren't developed yet. I was going to let them down. Wasn't it obvious? I was a baby, a shy, scared, nervous, insecure, self-hating little girl, a deer in the headlights holding a power that I couldn't believe was real. Yes, others agreed with me that it wasn't real and that I didn't deserve it, and those people weren't shy about stating their case. Juliana Hatfield is lame, etc. Success, or dreams coming true, is complicated, never as simple and perfect as you think it's going to be. So she makes the most of it now while she has the opportunity, because one day, probably not too far from now, they will forget about her. They will stop throwing money her way, they will stop believing in her, they will stop returning her calls. She lets one kid finally buy his girl an engagement ring, throws a pile of bills out the window and sticks her head out and watches the happy people down below catching the free money floating down from heaven. It's her one chance to live it up now, before they take it, the money, the chance, away. Enjoy it, the freedom, while she has it, because it will never be like this again. She knows she's nothing more to them than a commodity, an object. They don't care about her art or her heart. She knows it is thus, and they are not the bad guy. They are just what they are. There's her, and there's them. Just the way it is. Just the way the world turns. It has always been thus, she thinks. She orders room service, surrounded by friends, penniless friends, struggling friends, good-hearted friends, who live hand-to-mouth, paycheck to paycheck. It's like she's Robin Hood. She's sharing the spoils. She orders room service, one of everything, and leaves a 100% tip, because she has always wanted to do that, and now she can. Just like I've always wanted to run into the airport and go up to the nearest ticket counter and say, "Get me on the next plane out of here." She's having a big, fun, little bit mournful, bittersweet celebration of the fleeting never-againness of now. In the midst of joy and love, there is the consciousness that nothing lasts. Moments must be savored because they disappear so fast like cigarette smoke. The fugitive tenderness of those eyes, I read that somewhere, sums up a lot of stuff for me. She buys guitars for all the kids. Isn't that a worthy use? One of the worthiest? Of the, or of any, money? The importance of arts, and arts funding, is the subtext of my new song, Such a Beautiful Girl, from How to Walk Away. She also uses some of the money to set up one of her addicted friends in a nice, posh rehab in the country, so he can get clean in a comfortable environment. She should be happy, right? Record deal equals happiness and success, right? But the equation isn't that simple for her. She's conflicted. She's getting attention now, but it doesn't mean that anyone really cares about her. Money doesn't fix everything. For me, it's not true that they never cared. Some did. Some still do. A select, loyal few. When I wrote the song, I had just been let go by the label who had signed me up 5 or so years earlier, so I was feeling like I'd been thrown out like a piece of trash. The song was a snapshot of a moment of extreme hurt, keep that in mind. This was, I think, my first recorded slide guitar. I love how this particular slide part makes me feel. It does something to my heart and I can't explain it, and I didn't do it on purpose. I was so pleasantly surprised by what came through my hands. It's the mystery of music. The part is so pretty and sad and nostalgic and heartbreaking, even to me, the one who played it.
This can't be real. I've never seen so much. This must be a joke. I don't know how to feel. I haven't earned it yet. Everything fades so fast. Let's buy a car with cash and crash it. Buy her the rock she always wanted. Throw money out the window, watch the happy people catch it.
I have no idea what I was thinking when I wrote this song. I really can't remember. It was so long ago. Was I talking about some concept of God? Was I talking about my mad crush on a guy, a crush that I was sure was not just a crush, but was true, lasting, faithful, forever love? In the song, it sounds like I'm asserting my undying faith, or my integrity, or my stick-to-itiveness, or my love, or my loyalty. To what, to whom, I'm not sure. And it seems I don't understand why others, for example, the love object in the song, don't see what I see and believe what I believe. It's odd to have written a song and to not have any memory of writing it, or of what was going through my mind when I wrote it. When I listen to this song, it's kind of like you listening to this song, kind of a mystery. Sounds like a person I don't know, a stranger, is singing. Whatever I meant with this song, I really meant it. I was very serious. But funny too, don't you think? Quoting Mae West, "Why don't you come up and see me sometime?" That's funny, right? Why doesn't anyone think my songs are funny? I do. I just listen to Get Off Your Knees and I dissolved in a puddle of giggles. Mike Watt's bass line alone is enough for a huge, song-long grin. In No Answer, I reference yet again, escaping in my car with no plan but to just go. Jump in my car, turn the music on. I'm gonna be gone, but I don't know for how long. People can criticize me for many things. They can make multiple harsh negative judgments about me and my music, but they can't say that I'm inconsistent. I've always written about driving in my car as a way to feel free and to think without any distractions. It's a theme I have often returned to. I'm wearing a wig on all the Hey Babe album photographs. Does everyone know that? I had a short, dirty, blonde, boyish haircut at the time. The photographer took the album shots. Jesse Perez, who was the bass player in the original Lemonheads, brought a dark wig with bangs to the shoot and had me try it on. I was game. Later, Jesse directed my Everybody Loves Me But You video, and he brought the same wig along to the video shoot in New York. You can see my short hair in a couple of shots in the video. One other thing no one ever discussed was the fact that I pretty much invented a whole genre of music with Hey Babe. Indie prog. People called it indie pop or indie rock, but it's totally prog. Executed with an indie sensibility. Okay, well maybe Everybody Loves Me But You and Forever Baby are basically basic traditional pop. But some of the deeper cuts, Quit, probably the proggest song on the album, No Outlet, Nirvana, and this one, are not unprog at all. Maybe because the record is overall so tuneful and sing-songy and melodically nursery rhyme-like, and because the lyrics are vulnerable and innocent and angsty and girlishly tortured in the way that only an adolescent love-struck girl can be. And also maybe because most, if not all, prog rock has been created by men, no one ever classified the album properly. One noticeably proggy thing in this song is the two bars of the seven bookended with the bars of eight in the pre-choruses. Another is the excruciatingly long, painstakingly choreographed outro. And then there is my spazzy bass playing throughout the album, and the willfully weird song structures. There's even a fucking gong smash in this song. The start of the excruciatingly long, painstakingly choreographed outro. I would like to play this song live again, but I can't figure out how to play the weird chords and voicings that my bold, young, nerdy brain dreamed up, and I'm afraid that my band and I, all of us of a certain, increasingly forgetful, closer to Alzheimer's onset age, won't be able to remember all the parts, if we are able to ever learn them, or in my case, relearn them. Thank you. back seat. I wanted someone to take care of me, to help me. I wanted to feel safe, to be like a child again, lying in the back seat of the grown-up's car, with the humming of the engine and the motion and the dark outside and the music on the radio lulling me to sleep. But I was alone in the metaphorical car, and whatever I was struggling with, whatever path I was trying to tread without running out of gas. But I have written quite a few driving in a car and actual real car songs. The world can always use more driving in a car songs, don't you think? Driving has always felt like a kind of freedom to me and an escape. I have clarity in my car. It is so nice sometimes to get away from a boring party, from a fight, from the confusion that is other people, from whatever, from everything. Travel, even just traveling a few miles on a road, makes life feel different, more important, more spectacular, more meaningful, more electrified. The motion in the world going past, and going past the world, lends everything a kind of transcendence. It's exciting to leave something behind and to go towards something else, even if you don't know what it is you're heading toward, even if it is toward the unknown. And when you're driving, you're always, necessarily, leaving something behind, even if temporarily, and you're always going towards something else. The angel takes the wheel part is a fantasy. It's me wanting things to not be so difficult, wanting a hand to help, to hold, wanting to just take a break from my life that had veered off track since I'd just been dropped from my record label, Atlantic, and which, come to think of it, I was realizing had never really been very on track, emotionally speaking. I was tired of having to figure out everything on my own, tired of feeling bad and not understanding why or how to change it. I wanted to rest, to stop struggling, to be comforted, to let my tears pour out of me and release the pain, fear, sadness, worry, frustration, loneliness, to drop the facade and stop pretending I was happy, to not have the responsibility of making myself happy, to take a back seat to my own life when it seemed too overwhelming and confusing, to let someone else run my life, to give it over to some benign, loving, non-judgmental, understanding force, to God, to the fantasy angel. Love and empathy and understanding were lacking in my personal life. People seemed to not be there when I needed them. Or if they were there, I wouldn't know how to begin to reach out and tell them how I felt, to say what I wanted to say, to tell them what I needed so badly to get off my chest. How hard can it be to speak clearly, I asked of myself, angrily. My inability to express myself to others who would conceivably be sympathetic, understanding, and helpful was my main source of woe. You'd think communication would be simpler for a writer, but that isn't always the case. Simply conversing was difficult and complicated for me, and as a result, I felt bereft and invisible and mute. I gave nothing, so I got nothing. I still give nothing and get nothing, but the difference between now and then is that now I want nothing. In class, in school, if I had the right answer in my head when the teacher asked a question, I wouldn't raise my hand. The teacher would call on someone else, and I would berate myself in my head for not speaking out with what I knew to be true. How did I expect people to listen to me when I didn't say anything? How could I make them know I knew? In the song, I make it known that I know you know. You, the one who is mute and can't speak up. Don't you know I know is saying that you don't have to say it. I know what you mean and what you feel without you having to express it. I wish someone would do and be that for me. I think I made my music because it was a way to communicate. I had very little interaction with people in my everyday life when I wasn't working. I'm still the same, only now I don't worry about it so much. Now I know that talking is, more often than not, a waste of everyone's time. I go whole days without actually speaking to a real live person in person. I used to think I was pathologically closed off, reticent, and reserved, but now I think that the world would maybe be a better place if people kept their mouths shut like I do. If more people learned to make themselves invisible, and if more people could disappear into the background, if none of us had the need to make ourselves known, if we knew ourselves, if only we could all know. This song, especially the bridge, is trying so hard to be hopeful. It wants to be happy, but it doesn't know how yet. But it has tons of faith. It's trying to believe that I, we, am, are not as alone as I, we, think I, we, am, are, and that I am. Okay, come on, Julian Hatfield, be serious. I can't read that. It's about not giving up, about picking yourself up from a low place and keeping going, because what's unknown up ahead could be great and better than where we are now. In the bridge, Todd the drummer thought that he was hitting the cymbal on the 1 and the 3, but his counting was screwed up in his head and he was accidentally and unknowingly hitting on the 2 and the 4, making a syncopated beat until the full drums came back in. Todd's mistake sounded cool to me. I liked it and didn't ask him to redo it, to do it right. It was a case of something wrong is right. With the words sleeping with Jesus, I certainly never meant to imply that anything improper was ever going on in my head between me and the Son of God. Jesus was simply a symbol of love and empathy, the love and empathy I wanted, needed, and craved, and of one particularly righteous soundtrack to falling happily asleep, back when the world was my oyster.
Yeah.
metal fume fever. You could look at metal fume fever as my modern, abbreviated, musical version of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. I wasn't thinking of the jungle when I wrote Metal Fume Fever, but listening to the song now, I can see a connection between it and the book. Metal fume fever is the name of an actual illness. When I first heard the term in passing, I thought, I have to use that as a song title. It rocks. I knew next to nothing about the illness then. All I knew was that hearing those words conjured up nightmarish images in my head, and those images were what I wrote about, in protest. It's a protest song. I threw in that bit about making weapons for Southern lovers because I was involved with a Southerner for a little while, and he had a gun, which he liked to sometimes take out and admire and show off to people in his living room. I don't think he ever shot the thing, and I suspect he didn't even have any bullets. I think he just thought a gun was a cool rock and roll thing to have. Somebody had to manufacture that gun. That gun that was just a showpiece used to impress visitors. Someone in some gun factory, somewhere. Someone breathing in daily, deadly toxic fumes, perhaps. That's my old bass player, Mikey Welsh, who later went on to play in Weezer at the beginning of the song Yelling. I told him to, I directed him. And taking big swigs out of a bottle. I didn't tell him to do that, that was his choice. At one point, it sounds uncannily like a bong, but it's not. It's just innocent bottle guzzling.